And we're back recording. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's move to item 4A2, case number 19-17, Nicolette Owens, physical therapist.
Hi, can you see me?
Hi.
Oh,
yes. So.
Thank you, people.
Dr. Cornwell, this is an informal hearing, so you need to go through the informal hearing script, please.
Okay. So let's start by.
Let me interrupt you for just 1 minute. Is there anybody else here to speak to case 1917 other than Ms. Weinsberg and Ms. Owens? Okay, proceed.
Okay, so let's introduce the board members and staff.
Dr. King, professional member?
Here.
Mr. Clinton, public member?
Here.
Mr. Greer, public member?
Here.
Ms. Remick, professional member?
Here.
Dr. Cornwell, president and professional member?
Here.
Ms. Hunter, professional member?
Present.
Dr. Bastillo, professional member?
Here.
Ms. Crowley?
Present.
Ms. Cardoza?
Present.
Ms. Richardson?
Present.
Ms. Chepius?
Present.
And the Assistant Attorney General, Ms. Baskins?
Present.
Okay. So, let's, this interview is being held pursuant to ARS 32-2046. The purpose of an informal hearing is to hear relevant facts by way of testimony and exhibits to determine if a violation of any of the board statutes or rules has occurred. If the board finds a violation, it may take any or all of the following disciplinary action. 1, issue a decree of censure. 2, place restrictions upon a licensee's practice. 3, issue a civil penalty of not more than $500. 4, issue other disciplinary action. 5, issue a non-disciplinary order requiring completion of continuing education as specified by the board. If the board finds that the violation or possible violation of statute or rule is not sufficiently serious to warrant disciplinary action, the board may issue a non-disciplinary advisory letter. If the board finds that there was no violation of the board's statutes and rules, the board may dismiss the case. If the board finds that the violations warrant suspension or revocation of the license, the board shall vote the matter to a formal hearing. Okay. Would somebody please, the investigator or Karen, give us a brief overview of the complaint?
This is Mindy. I can provide that.
Okay. Thank you. And Ms. Richardson, please provide the potential allegations, please.
You want the numbers?
Yes, that's fine. And okay. A short description would be perfect.
Okay. Based on the investigation by board staff and the board's initial review of this complaint, it's alleged that Ms. Owens, 1, engaged in the performance of substandard care, 2, failed to maintain adequate patient records, 3, charged unreasonable or fraudulent fees for services performed or not performed, and 4, made misleading, deceptive, untrue, or fraudulent representations in violation of this chapter or the practice of the profession.
All right, thank you. I just want to make sure that I've got everybody down who would like to be speaking. First, Ms. Owens, I'm assuming you, and then you have with you, what, I didn't catch the name.
Hi, my name is Lauren Weinswipe, and counsel for Nikki.
Okay. Is there anyone else who is here to speak relative to case number 19-17? Okay. All those individuals who will be speaking, I need to swear you in. So if you'd raise your right hand. You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
I do.
Ms. Owens, can you confirm?
Yes.
And Ms. Richardson?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Ms. Owens, either you or your attorney, would you like to make an opening statement?
Yes, we'll have Nikki make an opening statement and I can make the closing statement. That's all right with the board. Okay, so can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, great, cool. So board members, staff, my name is Nikki Owens for short. It's nice to actually finally put some faces to the names of everybody. Thank you for this opportunity for me to be here today to talk about JD's case and his, my patient in January of 2019. I'd like to start by saying that I'm a very good person. I care much more about other people than I do myself to a fault. I love being a therapist. I do believe it was my calling. I absolutely love what I do. I take good pride in it. And I love when I can help patients meet their goals. I had a very good relationship with him and his wife. I absolutely loved when they came into the clinic. They were a really great couple. I was personally devastated when he fell. I still am a year and a half later. And apparently he's gone through a lot since then, and I'm beyond devastated by it. I've replayed it over and over and over in my head. It never gets easier to this day. I had never had a patient fall, and I certainly don't want that to ever happen again. Going through this entire process, it is new for me. It's caused me to reflect a lot on my time with the patient in specific, and then just my overall practice in general. I've been accused of all these things, and yes, there are areas that I could definitely improve on with my practice. I've only been a PT for 4 years. I've been in the field for 10 years. I've been a patient a bunch of times, and I just finished my own rehab from the shoulder. So this is my life, and I love being in it. I have taken quite a few documentation courses. We do annual compliance reviews for ATI, and I've taken another one that I've been educated by my employer. We have updated our policies and procedures that if something does go wrong, then we are to call 911 no matter if the patient refuses. I have taken steps to be much more thorough in my documentation. I try not to leave anything out. I'm doing better at taking vitals, especially on initial evaluations. Especially with those with medically complex patients such as JD's. I rarely see them. We are primarily outpatient orthopedics, but I'm trying to make more of a conscious effort to do so. I also do try to communicate with physicians in much more in depth than just leaving a voicemail. And I'm doing better at putting that in my daily note or in our clinical that we have. I am an extremely honest person. I have a really hard time lying. I've never tried to deceive you, Mindy, the investigator, or even, the patient and his family. I know there's a lot of statements that differ from mine and from the patient and his family's, but I know what happened. I know that I caught him, I bear hugged him, and I grabbed him, and I did help him lower to the floor. The only thing that hit the floor was his right hip. I had my arms underneath his armpits, like a bear hug. God forbid, had we actually fallen like you said he did, and then I came over, he would have definitely hit a lot more than just his hip. I more than once suggested and wanted to call 911, wanted to get some sort of x-ray, get him to a doctor's office, anything so that I can rule out a fracture or an even broken hip. I've had several broken bones and they hurt very bad, and I never want that to happen to anybody. He kept saying no. He kept saying no, it feels like a bone bruise, I'll be okay. But he kept saying no. We work right down the hall from Paradise Valley Family Medicine's office, and I didn't offer that, or there was a fast med urgent care right down the road. We refused all of those. I would absolutely never make a patient walk after a fall, especially if he was crying or if he was in a tremendous amount of pain. He wasn't crying at all right there. If he did, it was when he went home. But I would have never agreed to let him walk had I knew something terrible had happened. And I know there are inconsistencies in how much he did walk, so I wanted to clear that up a bit. After we got him to standing, he did walk about 1 to 2 feet just to get to the treatment table to sit down and talk again more about what we could do. And then he agreed to ice for a little bit while I went to go get the walker from down the hall, the wheelchair down the hall. And he was very adamant about wanting to walk out. He wanted to, and I told him I was very highly against it, but he wanted to. So I held him very tight with the gate belt on his right side. And I walked him out to about midway down the hall towards the lobby. I'm not sure about how his memory is with how large the actual clinic is, but it was about 40 feet from the treatment table to the suite's front door, which was always open. And then he walked probably about another 60 feet before I made him sit down. I did not feel comfortable for him continuing. His wife had, his wife was already out getting the car. The PV Family Medicine's office was right there. And I said, are you sure you don't want to? It's right there. I know all of those doctors very well. He still said no. In regards to, I know Mindy asked me a lot about, is this patient relevant for outpatient or for neuro rehab? ATI is a very fast-paced orthopedic clinic. There are a bunch of similarities, but there are a lot of differences with those, and I am very well aware of those. I've actually sent two patients to neuro rehab in the last year because I knew that they weren't outpatient orthopedic any longer. In an outpatient orthopedic clinic, we are more comfortable with our patients, as a vast majority of them are at a higher level and do not always require a need for a gait belt or constant hands-on supervision. They are community engagers. We and I specifically narrow down my attention to one-to-one based off if they need to be constant supervision, hands-on, contact guard assist, standby assist, min assist, etc. JD was only doing, general strengthening at the time and not much balancing. Had he had done more balancing things like, marching on the air reps or obstacle courses or step ups or anything with more dynamic movements, absolutely I would have had a gait belt on him. No questions asked. I know that, and I have never changed. I know that, and I do that. I honestly do not know why in my daily note on his last visit that I said he was wearing a gait belt. I didn't write it in my discharge summary, and I didn't write it in the incident report. I wasn't trying to, you know, cover anything up. I made a mistake. I was writing that very fast, and I was and still am pretty frazzled about it. I also don't have a good explanation of why my incident report doesn't mention my suggestion that we call 911 multiple times. I can only say that this is something that's never happened before. And, you know, nobody really ever trained you on how to write an incident report. And I never had anybody review it before I submitted it. I just tried to put as much in there as I could. I do feel like I caught Jim the best that I could. I'm sorry, JB. To minimize any injury. I was standing right behind him. I was maybe about a foot or two behind him. We were doing side steps, and I mean, he had done that previously without any issues. And he had his hands on the countertop. He tripped over his right foot or his right toe, and he let go of the countertop, and I reached in and grabbed him, but it happened so fast that he just went down. I'm a former cheerleader, so that's how I'm trained and how I'm instinctively, you know, catch people. I've been doing that since I was 10 years old. It's not, you know, in me to reach for a belt, but I like bear hug the person if something were to happen. However, you know, looking upon this, I learned a lot on this, and I've learned to change that ever since. Everybody always uses a gate belt when they're doing any kind of balance activity, whether it's with me or my PTA, especially if they don't have any upper extremity support. They are with contact bar assistance with the gate belt at all times. With that being said, being here and doing this is pretty frightening. I don't know if you can tell in my voice. But I view this as a big learning experience for me. I'm documenting much better, way more thorough in regards to subjective, in regards to pain, in regards to anything and everything about an initial evaluation. I'm documenting as much as I possibly can. I'm a Virgo, I'm a perfectionist. I don't like when I miss something. So if the board believes that I could benefit from additional CEUs, I would love that. I love nothing more than learning, and you know, there's always something that you can learn. There's always something that I can be better at. There's always something that, you know, I could be educated more in detail, especially, you know, those with medically complex patients or comorbidities, I'm sorry. You know, we are primarily ortho, so I would love to learn that extra 5 to 10% that I don't normally see. Mindy asked me, you know, what I wanted the board to know before we finished our interview, and I'm not sure if I gave her too much of a clear answer. I was a little frazzled. I knew I wanted to be a PT in college, and the first day of, you know, observing in a PT clinic with one of my mom's friends who is a PT, I was one of those weird people that loved going to PT for my knee in high school. I love how you see something new every day. I love how there's just so much to know about the human body. I care a lot about my patients. I always want to see them improving. I love when, you know, a patient comes in and says, thank you for helping me do this. Finally able to do it again. That's what I truly love about being a PT. While I know I'm not perfect, I do believe that I'm a great therapist, and I've always had my best interests, or my patient's best interests at heart. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. part of the inquiry is finished, and that I'm asking, well, getting your statement. And now we'll open up, and I'm assuming that you'll be willing to answer any questions that the board might have.
Yeah.
Okay. So does anyone on the board have any questions for Ms. Owens?
Yes, I have some. This is Mike Clutton. Did I hear you correctly that when the patient fell and then wanted to leave and you were helping him back to the vehicle, at that point he had a gait belt on?
Yes.
Okay. And previous to the fall, he did not have a gait belt?
Doing sidesteps, no.
Okay. What was your rationale for this patient that he shouldn't have a gait belt on before the fall?
The biggest thing is that he's a community ambulator. He had his hands on the countertop. He had previously done this exercise before without any issues. And I was standing right behind him. And normally he did wear, pants with an actual belt on it. I just can't recall if he was wearing that at that time.
So you didn't assess him whether he should have a gait belt?
When we're going to do more balancing exercises after that required contact guard assist, a gait belt would have been on, absolutely. I don't know why it wasn't on right away. It was my judgment at the time, yeah, because he had done it before, he was safe doing it, and he had his hands on the countertop.
Yeah, that's all I have. Thank you.
Ms. Owens, this is Peggy Hunter. So, nobody thinks you're a bad person or not a good therapist. You must be good because you're a Virgo, because I am. But the problem is the problem with accidents is that you never know when they're going to happen. So, this patient, even though he was on medications, my understanding, you can correct me, his diastolic was 50, which is pretty low. He had the Berg balance test showed significant severe balance deficits, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit of a loss of why this patient, from the moment he came into the clinic, did not have a gait belt on. Because when I went to school and people said, why should we put a gait belt on someone? The answer was always, you can hurt yourself trying to catch them, or you can grab their clothing, it could rip and they'll go down. Whereas a gait belt isn't designed to keep the patient upright, but per se have more control when he's going down. So I think this is a real problem. And as far as him not wanting to go to the hospital, I think it would have been pertinent to explain to him he could be in shock. He may not realize he's hurt, and it would be at his best interest. So I'm a little bit of a loss why, A, you didn't have a gait belt on him from the minute he walked into the clinic, et cetera. So I'd like to hear your explanation for that.
I honestly don't know why it wasn't on him. It was in, it was my initial judgment. I definitely learned from it, and there's always a gait belt on somebody such as him, such as patient. His hindsight's 2020. My hindsight is 2020. I honestly don't know why gait belt wasn't on him at that time. I felt that he and I were both comfortable with me sitting right behind him.
Okay, so in your professional opinion, who should have a gait belt on them?
Who should have a gait belt on them?
Right.
every patient doing balance exercises.
Okay. So to me, this is a little bit like closing the barn door after the horses escaped. It doesn't mean you're a bad person or a bad therapist, but I definitely feel you need to learn from this error.
I definitely have.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
This is Mark Cornwall. Your objective portion of your exam seems to be kind of sparse given his history. And the things that you did test, it seems like you might have even ignored. The biggest one is that he scored a 30, where was it? 36 out of on the Berg balance test, and that's pretty bad. So did you consider that just a baseline, or did you consider that a red flag, or
both, honestly? A lot more of his impairments with the Berg balance was more the dynamic activities, the tandem balance. I think it was, you know, turning his whole body, but it was more of the dynamic movements that were of way more of concern. I didn't expect it as a red flag. I do home health, and I see this pretty frequently, and, you know, I'm always 100% there all of the time with a gait belt on with those patients. So I'm very well aware of how to treat a balanced patient. That's the clinic that I grew up in as a PT tech, was by Sun Lakes. So we did a lot of balance in you know, static positions, dynamic positions on uneven and even surfaces. So I felt fairly confident in treating, you know, JD and his balance, but we didn't even really get into that too much.
Did you have a conversation with him about his balance and the low balance score? Because a 36 out of 56 indicates that he has a really high possibility he's going to fall within the next 6 months.
So
you talking about getting a walker, a cane, you know?
Yes, I definitely talked to him about, you know, the definition of it, and he understood. He used a cane. You know, sometimes he didn't use it in the house. I told him he needs to use, you know, a cane in the house at all times. I think he had just transitioned from a walker, if I'm not mistaken, to being comfortable on a cane in the community. I'm not sure when that happened, but he was using a cane, and I told him not to let that go if he's going out in the community especially.
Okay. There, and you also have some scores in here that I'm not real familiar with. Maybe it's just the abbreviation, but he had an LEFS of 36. I know what that is. BR of 12. That's the mental component. A 30. BR 12 mental component summary of 30. The BR 12 physical component summary of 44. What do those numbers tell us?
The BR 12 is the patient's, how they feel their general health is, not just about, you know, their impairment in particular, but just about their overall general health. You know, do they feel that they have good, I can pull it up. I don't know what 100, I don't want to,
So how would you improve 44 on the physical component summary?
So it's just basically, you know, how you would say your overall health is in general. Would you, during the past 4 weeks, have you had any problems physically, emotionally? Have you been feeling anxious, depressed? You know,
so what does a 44 mean?
So a 44 means moderate functional limitations. And the 30 points of the mental means marked functional limitations.
Okay. All right. There were some other things that are silent in the note. For example, no neurologic tests, even though he complains of numbness and tingling. No assessment of the pain. So were those things done and just didn't get documented, or they weren't done at all?
I do my best at, you know, asking very specifically about pain. I know with Medicare that you can't treat what the referral doesn't have. So the referral from Dr. Gitt just said, you know, unsteady gait. Had it said also treat low back pain or leg pain or radiculopathy, stenosis, anything like that, I would have absolutely gone way more in depth with pain assessment, you know, where it is, does it radiate? Is it deep? Is it something that you can touch? What makes it better? What makes it worse? So on and so forth. I would have absolutely gone way more into depth with that. Jim had mentioned in specific that he only gets numbness and tingling when he walks, you know, out in the community. He didn't have any right then and there sitting down, or even throughout our whole session. For I think that 55 minutes there. So it was a little difficult to assess that if he didn't have any right then and there. Like I said, I probably should have gone more into depth with that. And I do now. I just know from, you know, being drilled about Medicare, you know, treat what's on the referral. And you can't treat beyond that unless it says it on the referral. So yes, I should have gone more into detail about the pain assessment. But I was just going based off of the referral things.
So you feel like you're restricted to whatever the referral says?
Yes and no. Treatment-wise, yes, but assessment-wise, no.
So what if the pain is a factor in his poor balance? Then
I don't know if he said it was or it wasn't. I did read Dr. Gitt's referral extensively. It was pretty long, and it said that we have it. That it was most likely contributed to the many TIAs that he was having. Dr. Gitt, I don't think, did any, you know, x-rays or MRIs or anything on his low back to rule out or rule in degeneration or stenosis or radiculopathy. So I was just going off of everything that Dr. Gitt was saying in his referral. And I realized that that's my own mistake. I should not, you know, rely just on referrals and subjectives. I need to do better at actually doing them in my evaluation.
Yeah, because this is starting to sound like you're acting like a technician, and whatever the doctor says, that's all you're going to do. Is that how you view your job?
No, absolutely not. You know, if somebody comes in with knee pain or hip pain, I rule in or rule out, you know, the lumbar spine, the foot, and then the mechanics of the foot. I look at their gait. I try to hone in on what's actually going on so that I can better treat them.
Okay, so that's great. So now tell me how you applied those principles to this particular patient and their problem.
JD initially came and just said that he was feeling a little bit more unsteady, the more he walked. So that's just kind of where I guided my assessment and my evaluation, is to say, hey, let's get this guy a lot stronger. He, scored only like 3+ out of 5 on some of the strength tests. And, I like to build up that strength a little bit more in order to progress to more balanced exercises. So that's just kind of where I was going. And a lot of the times with, low back pain, with radiculopathy, with stenosis, with degeneration, low back pain, they get better with activity. They get better with strengthening. So that's just kind of where I was starting at and going towards.
Okay. I think I'm done for now. My questions. Anyone else have questions?
I do. This is Nishka Remick. I know for me, a lot of the issue is around how you attempted to block the fall or prevent the fall. And I'm just sort of curious, why do you think the patient has the sense that you were not present or next to him prior to the fall? I think their statement was that you were at a table documenting. Why do you think they said that?
I have absolutely no idea. I was behind him, directly behind him, within like a few inches to a foot for the first lap of lateral walking. And he was very safe. He didn't need any cues. So I took one step back to give him a little bit more confidence in himself. And it was when that happened. So he was more on like a very far left side of the wall. And I took that step back. It was in 1 to 2 steps to the right that he tripped over his right foot because he didn't pick it up high enough. And then I had to lunge and reach forward and underneath him to grab him. And it just happened so fast. I don't know how I couldn't have caught him. I had a very weak shoulder at that point. So I know that's not an excuse, but I did step back. But there was absolutely no way I would ever be documenting or ever be turning my back towards a patient doing anything standing, especially with this kind of patient. Never, never, absolutely not. I would never turn my back. And I would definitely not be documenting. If I was documenting and I had turned my back, I wouldn't have caught him, to be honest. And I did. And I lowered him to the ground as much as I could. So I don't know why he would say that, to be honest.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay. you or your attorney would like to make a closing statement?
Yes, please. Thank you. Both Nikki and I appreciate your time today.
and her opportunity to answer your questions and provide your further information. As she's conveyed to you today and in a letter we submitted, unfortunately, you can't change what happened. You can just take an event like this and learn from it, which is what's been done. They've updated their policy at the clinic, like she said, so that 911 be called in these events, even if the patient refuses. She's monitoring and taking blood pressure in the outpatient facility more frequently, especially with respect to these complex cardiovascular patients. She does this in a home health practice. She did have our student recently do an in-service on the use of a gait belt. And obviously this has taught her the clear importance of taking the time to accurately document in time of crisis and to include critical detail on an incident report. We agree that her documentation and JD's record could be improved. She's taken CEUs, which we attached to our letter. And we did research the possibility of building a professor two course, but I don't know if it was because of COVID or what, but it's apparently not available until August. With respect to her interactions with you folks and the board investigator, she's been cooperative. She's told her story the best she remembers it. She's under oath for today. And we know that JD's statements, just like the last question intimated, are obviously not in agreement with Nikki's in some respects. And honestly, in some cases, their statements aren't in agreement with one another's or the records. And we can't explain why what she said. All we can do is assure the board that, you know, she's done her best to recall what happened with respect to the treatment she provided him, with respect to what happened when he fell and after. She was standing right behind him. She wasn't sitting. She wasn't documenting. She saw him trip on his foot, but she was documenting. She wouldn't have been able to see that. Got him under his armpits, controlled his fall. He injured his hip, but if she hadn't been there, he had hurt his hand, arm, ribs, neck, head. I don't know, but it would have been worse. So she was there, and the PTA also said she, you know, was there and caught him and was under him. He didn't appear to be in all that much pain. That also was something agreed to by the PTA. He wasn't teary or crying. And she said she can never force a patient who appeared to have tears in his eyes or was in such excruciating pain that way to walk down a hallway. But he insisted he walk. And I just want to clarify that the PTA statement to Ms. Richardson during, I think it was her, the PTA's interview, was that, quote, he was adamant about wanting to walk. I think he was just trying to play it off like he was okay. And I think in retrospect, and having listened to the PTA's interview, which we didn't get until after we had submitted our response, but having listened to that interview, there's part that's not in the transcript, but there was kind of like a joke and an interaction between the interviewer and the family about how he may be just a proud Marine. There's a proud Marine in there somewhere. And I'm speculating, obviously, but I think that could be what happened, that either he wasn't actually in pain or he was just prideful and didn't, you know, want to let on that he was in as much pain as he was. Yeah, and he unfortunately didn't tell Nikki. In any event, he didn't agree to have an ambulance come. He didn't want to see the folks down the hallway at the family medicine clinic. And he did walk a fair distance down the hallway. And I think, again, looking at all the different statements, it appears, you know, now I have been to the clinic and looked at where he was just lying on the table, which was about 20 feet from the front door. And I just said, even he admitted he walked halfway down the hallway. That's a good other 40, 50 feet that he went. So it appears that the person who had the most sense of distance or accurate distance was the PTA when she said to the investigator that he walked at least out of the clinic, maybe 100 to 150 feet. And having been there and paced it out, I think that's the most accurate. So again, so why are these statements not recorded? Why did Nikki only say he went 50 feet? Why did she write in the daily note he was wearing a gait belt on the 24th, but not on the 27th in the Medicare discharge summary? Why doesn't the incident report have this important detail? And our only explanation is that, you know, she's never had this happen before. She's never been through something like this before. It's, you know, she took it very personally. She took it hard. She'd never written an incident report before. She hadn't had training on it. But I think, you know, in retrospect, if this were to happen in the future, can be assured that the contemporaneous documentation would be much more detailed than that. She said it. I want to reiterate it. She hasn't tried to mislead the investigator. She hasn't tried to be dishonest with you at any time. She made mistakes in how she documented what happened that day. I note that even in my letter to you, I see typos, I see things that I kind of cringe at when I look at it. I'm like, oh, God, I wish I would have corrected that. Even the investigative hearing brief, you know, or formal hearing brief, excuse me, references in some section another patient and another PT, which is a whole other investigation. So it's like we all make mistakes. And it's not, you know, you said nobody thinks he's a bad person, but she's been accused of lying to all of you and being deceptive. And that's not at all what's happened here. She just feels, you know, she was very anxious. She felt terrible. And she was inexperienced and naive. And frankly, I think those are two things we can say she is no longer. You know, something that nobody asked any questions about, but one of the findings or conclusions of law is that she engaged in fraudulent or charged unreasonable fees or fraudulent, engaged in fraudulent billing with respect to two codes, one on the 10th for home education, one on the 24th for assessment or equipment. Again, if he doesn't engage in fraudulent billing or intentionally trying to overcharge the patient, I think she chose those codes because she thought they were the correct thing to choose. And ironically, the investigative hearing brief suggests on the home education program that she charged, that she should have charged the more expensive charge. Well, that just can't be a violation of the law then if she actually charged the patient less than what somebody else thinks she should have charged. And actually it's Medicare program. So in other words, she undercharged the Medicare program with respect to that particular charge. And with respect to the assessment of the hip, we can only say that again, she was providing a skilled service. She was assessing his function and just believes that that's the correct charge. You know, ATI, that's the company that she works for. They have, you know, many, many employees across the United States, and they take regulatory and billing compliance very, very seriously, as I'm sure your employers, to the extent you are employed by other people, you know, they do. I mean, they are routinely audited by payers, including the Medicare and Medicaid managed care organizations. They're very aware of the consequences of fraudulent billing. I mean, I think we all are. And so, you know, as an organization, they make sure that their PTs are trained. And she's undergone training on billing practices. She does it annually. We included those in the letter to you. Yeah, can someone make a mistake in choosing a code? Yeah, that can happen. It happens to everybody. But, you know, it's just certainly not in trying to charge unreasonably or fraudulently. And we would really ask that you not substantiate that finding with respect to her. She's a good physical therapist. She, you know, experienced this terrible event. We don't think she provides substandard care. And we tried to show you with letters and patient testimonials just off the internet how well respected she is and how talented she is as a therapist and how devoted she is to her patients. I'm sure you can appreciate how hard it is to live with the knowledge that one of your patients fell and was injured. She's certainly, as she said, taken lessons from this, out of herself and her practice. We ask that you not impose discipline on Nikki. We're concerned about the negative effects such an action could have on our future employment prospects. Insurance contracts, patient relationships. Other than this one event with this patient, she's never had a patient call or even a patient complaint to either the board or one of her employers. It's not a case involving some pattern or trend. On the contrary, you do have evidence in your hands showing that, you know, people have been very satisfied, both patients and her employers, with her care. We therefore ask that if you're not inclined, obviously, to dismiss the matter, that if you see an opportunity for her to learn or improve her practice, that please enter an order for non-disciplinary education. She's more than willing to better herself. Like I said earlier, we looked at potentially enrolling her in the ProTech PT class, or even as the investigator suggested during the interview process, have her take a course managing medically complex patients or those with cardiovascular disease. Really, thank you for your time today and for your public service.
Thank you. All right. Then we will move into deliberation. We don't take any more, we won't be asking any more questions at this point. But we thank you for being here. So does anyone on the board want to start with either just a discussion or a motion?
This is Peggy Hunter.
Yep.
I just can't imagine with a patient like this that they would not have a gait belt on. That is not good. This patient had a history of strokes, TIAs. It's documented by his Berg balance test that he had significant severe balance deficits. To be behind someone when they're sidestepping on a with their hands on a ledge, there's not much to hold on to. If they'd been by the parallel bars or something, but the fact of the matter is, this patient should have had a gait belt on. I mean, this is PT 101. So it doesn't mean you're a bad therapist or not a good person, but I definitely think there should be some discipline involved with this case.
To me, it's more of a, I'm still trying to figure out whether or not her evaluation seemed to be awful skimpy, given his history, multiple TIAs within a month of her seeing him. She said he tripped over his foot. I wonder if the TIAs created a decreased dorsiflexion strength. And so he didn't pick his foot up enough because he didn't have adequate strength. We don't know that because she didn't do a thorough enough examination. So I don't know if she just cut corners, or did she not think that they were important, or she focused on just exactly what the script said, and that was balance. There's a lot of things that can cause somebody to have impaired balance, and that unless you address those, they're going to continue to have poor balance.
This is Nishka Remick. I'm with you, Dr. Cornwall. My impression is that this was it didn't seem like she understood necessarily the clinical signs that she was seeing. So to me, this seems to be less of a cutting corners and more of just not appreciating maybe the impact of some of the findings and then not correlating them on an ongoing basis. So for me, this is a education opportunity.
That would be consistent with not being able to tie her interventions to what his impairments were.
Right.
So all right, so if nothing else, just to kind of move forward, I move that we offer a non-disciplinary order of continuing education to include documentation and I would say red flags, maybe, or something like that. So. Because she can get a better idea of what do some of these tests mean exactly. I mean, so when you have a Berg balance test that comes out so poor that you're almost 100% sure that they're going to fall within 6 months, then that's a red flag that, hey, you know what? You ought to really watch this person closely.
I'm in a second for discussion, but I think I'd like to review or revisit the findings of fact. And conclusions of law.
There are no findings of fact or conclusions of law for a non-disciplinary order.
Okay, then how could I go about, so if I wouldn't have to omit one then?
Correct.
If I was not appropriate. Okay, thank you for clarifying.
So Dr. Cornwell, what I do need in your motion is how many hours of documentation, how many hours of assessment of the compact complex patient, which includes a balance component. How many hours would you like each of those courses?
6 hours of documentation, 3 hours of the complicated patient.
And in what time frame to complete?
1 year.
Early termination available?
Yes.
Okay, now we need a second.
Second, Nishka Remick.
You're in discussion.
Discussion about the motion.
Yeah,
once. So I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Once again, you know, you have a patient that falls and hurts themselves, you know. To me, since there was physical bodily harm, that raises this to a disciplinary nature of it. And I can't support a non-disciplinary letter of advisement in this case. It's, you know, you have a patient who, because of negligence, fell and ended up in the hospital, and the signs show that 100% chance the person would fall within the next 6 months. It was negligent, that wasn't taken to heart. And so that, to me, this rate rises to a disciplinary matter.
I agree with Mr. Clinton. I think this rises to a disciplinary action. In fact, it could have been much worse. The person could have fallen, hit their head, and et cetera. But I mean, I've put a gait ballot on people with less deficits than this person. And it's just a common sense type of decision. But so I am not in support of non-discipline. I'm sorry.
It's Kelly King. I am right there with you both, Peg, in that I work in rehab. I know falls happen even with the best safety precautions in place, gait belts to people next to you, things like that. It does seem a little risky that she did not have a gait belt on this patient. And then I do have to also note that I am concerned about the fact the patient was encouraged. Maybe not encouraged, I take that back. Not only discouraged, for lack of a better word, in ambulating on a hip without having it been assessed radiographically, and insisting that just cannot happen. When we have falls in our facility, the patients are not allowed to move until a physician has assisted them or assessed them, and that there's been some radiologic, especially if they hit on a hip. So I appreciate that there have been some changes in the process or policies in the clinic at this point, but a patient who falls and hits their hip at that age with the medical history this patient has had and being allowed to ambulate 2 feet, much less 100 feet, regardless of his insisting, for me is super problematic.
Any other comments, discussion? All right. It appears we're at the same place that we were with the last case. We've got an option. We can either vote this up and down since we have a motion and we have a second, or we can go through the modification. So I would prefer a cleaner approach.
Are you ready for the question? So on complaint 1917, Nicolette Owens, PT, you're voting on a non-disciplinary order to be completed within 1 year, which includes 6 hours of documentation, 3 hours of assessment of the complex patient, including a balance component. Dr. King?
No.
Mr. Clinton?
No.
Mr. Greer?
No.
Ms. Remick?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwall?
Yes.
Ms. Hunter?
No.
Dr. Bustillo?
No.
The motion fails.
Okay, so we're back. Since it appears that we're not interested in a non-disciplinary order, then let's consider findings of fact. Do we want to make a motion relative to findings of fact?
Make a motion that that the findings of fact as listed in the informal hearing documentation are accepted.
So just for clarification, under engaging in substandard care, there are items number 1 through 6. Under fail to maintain adequate patient records, there's 1. Under charging unreasonable or fraudulent fees, there are 2 findings of fact. Under making misleading, deceptive, untrue, or fraudulent representation, there are 3. Yes, 3 findings.
I would like to exclude, propose excluding the fraudulent charging, the last 2, I should say.
Okay, so it's your motion. So, Ms. King, it's your motion. So if you could clarify for me then which you are accepting and which ones you are deleting, please.
Gosh, I'll have to pull up the, hang on, I'll have to pull up the documentation.
Okay.
Hang on. It'll give me 1 second, please.
You may take all the time you'd like.
I think you're looking at page 3.
I am, but I need to get back to my drive. So hold on 1 second. I'm navigating back and forth between the screen and the drive. Okay. Apologies. Okay, finding of fact, A, engaging in the performance of substandard care.
So in those 6 statements, is there any that anybody, that you would like removed? And then we'll open it up for discussion.
Not in those 6 statements, no.
Okay, under B, failing to maintain adequate patient records, is there anything specific in the investigative report that you would like removed?
No.
Under charging unreasonable or fraudulent fees for services performed or not performed, there are 2 findings of facts. Do you want those to be included?
I would prefer they are not included.
Okay, that will be removed. Under making misleading, deceptive, or untrue fraudulent representations, there are 3 identified findings of fact. Would you like to amend or include any of those?
No, but I suspect we could amend if we need to, but at this point, no.
So to be clear, you want to keep all the findings of fact under D, making misleading, deceptive, or untrue statements?
I'm sorry, to correct, I would like to exclude D from findings of fact.
Okay, so the motion that needs seconded, just for clarification purposes, is to include under the performance of substandard care 1 through 6 and B adequate patient records with the removal of C and D. Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
You're in discussion.
All right.
For finding the fact.
I think the removal of these is appropriate because I think they all can be tied back to the first and second ones.
Yes.
So this is Peggy. I'm wondering if this is when we include the possible statute violations that the investigator has included in the investigative report.
No, no. This is the informal hearing.
Thank you, Mike.
No, but we're really close, Peggy. We're really close.
Yeah, you're past the investigative report. You're in an informal hearing.
Sorry.
So the motion before you is for findings of fact has moved and seconded. Ready? I'm sorry. Everybody ready for the question? Any discussion? All right.
Karen, would you kindly repeat the motion, please?
Sure. The motion before you is for findings of fact, which include A, engaging in the performance of substandard care, which is all six identified findings of fact in the informal hearing brief, as well as B, failing to maintain adequate patient records as indicated in the investigative report. Everybody ready for a vote? So for findings of, thank you. Findings of fact, Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Clinton?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Ms. Remick?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Ms. Hunter?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Findings of fact have been adopted. You're now on to conclusions of law, of which you have two.
I make a motion that we accept the conclusions of law regarding ARS 32-20444, engaging in performance of substandard care, and ARS 32-20440, failing to maintain adequate patient records.
Second.
All right, discussion on this motion?
I'm sorry, what was that, Dr. Cornwell?
Oh, just we're in discussion on that motion.
Yep.
Hearing none, then I call the question.
So on the motion to accept the conclusions of law, Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Clinton?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Ms. Remick?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Ms. Hunter?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
The conclusions of law have been accepted. You're now onto your board order.
Well, I'll move that leaves the same thing that I was going to do, non-disciplinary, is that is 6 hours of continuing education on documentation, 3 hours on a course on complicated patient, including balance, with a 1 year probation with early termination possible.
Is there a second?
Second, King.
All right, discussion on that? Any additions, any amendments people want to make?
So Dr. Cornwell, do you think the analysis and treatment of the geriatric, you think 3 hours is enough?
I think so.
Okay, but well, you know more
I'm
than
really
I.
Pain. I don't know exactly what's out there. I know that I would like her to be able to recognize when certain things are, quote, red flags, and that they're serious, and that we ought to be more careful, that if somebody comes in with a certain type of history, then that definitely takes you down the road to explore that further as part of your initial evaluation and see how it affects. So if we can't get that done in 3 hours, then we ought to up it.
Okay, thank you. And what about after the documentation course, to have a chart review?
I don't, at this point, I don't think that's required, but I'm, I'd be interested in what anybody else on the board has to say.
Okay, fair enough.
It's Kelly. I agree with you, Dr. Cromwell. I don't think that's I'm comfortable with not adding that.
So
I agree with that. This is Nishka Remick.
Yeah, I also in agreement with that. Lucio.
I also just wanted to clarify what's the language that we have as of now. Is it a minimum of 3 hours of the complicated patient or to include 3 hours?
I don't think there is language one way or the other.
It's 3 hours. So when they can prove a certificate or a certificate of completion has 3 or more hours, that would count for the disciplinary CEU requirement.
If by chance
she would take more hours, so she could then use those additional hours for her CEU requirements if she would like.
It's Kelly. I would like to discuss or consider allowing the courses to be completed through an online or WebEx venue.
I'm okay with that. Is the second okay?
I'm okay with that.
All right. If we make that a friendly amendment.
Yep. So accepted that both courses can be taken on an online version.
Okay.
This would be approved by the board prior to that, correct?
The board approves all CEUs prior.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, we ready for the vote?
So the order before you is complaint 1917, Nicolette Owens, PT, for 6 hours of documentation, 3 hours assessment of the complex patient that includes a balance component. Both courses can be completed online within 1 year with early termination available. You ready for the question?
Yes.
Excellent. Ms. King, Dr. King?
Yes.
Mr. Clinton?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Ms. Remick?
Yes.
Dr. Cornwell?
Yes.
Ms. Hunter?
Yes.
Dr. Bastida?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Karen, this might be a good time for you to stop and start the video again, or the video again.
I can do that.